sound, smell or touch the something inside that we need so much. The sight of a touch or the scent of a sound or the strength of an oak with roots deep in the ground. The wonder of flowers to be covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again. Or to fly to the sun without burning a wing. To lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing. To have all these things in our memories hoard and they use them.
This is an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Want to take a ride? To talk with Art Bell, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It absolutely is. It's the weekend, everybody, and you're off, and boy, do I have a guest for you, Bob Lazar. He is a man who is probably one of the more controversial people in the entire field of ufology. I mean, really controversial. Bob Lazar is president of United Nuclear. They specialize in research and development of cutting-edge technologies, design and manufacture of radiation detection equipment for the nuclear weapons industry, and the retail of scientific equipment and supplies. He was formerly senior staff physicist for the U.S. Department of Naval Intelligence at the Nevada test site, you know, that area near me, and a nuclear physicist at Los Alamos National Labs, where he was involved in advanced nuclear weapon design and development. And in the middle of all that, he's seen things that very few living Americans have ever seen. He's actually seen the ships. He's actually seen the saucers. In a moment, Bob Lazar. Some of you, I know, probably didn't hear the first program, or the last program, I guess I had to say, I did with Bob Lazar. He is a fascinating guy who got to see the real McCoy at Area S4 near, of course, the infamous Area 51. I guess it was a few weeks ago now, I interviewed our mutual friend, John Lear. Oh, what an interview that was, Bob. It was really something. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Art.
You know what? I'm going to start at the end. Why do you hate talking about UFOs?
Well, there's a few reasons. First of all, it's gotten pretty old. It's been, you know, over a decade.
Yeah.
And second of all, I'm glad I was involved in the project for a short time. But, you know, once you leave that and try and enter normal life, especially if you're peddling your services in research and development in the scientific field, it becomes really tough for people to take you seriously when you're known as the UFO guy. It's hard to kind of divorce all that stuff.
That's kind of the same problem that John Lear had, you know, when he was working for the airlines. It finally got to the point where he had to say no more, and for years, of course, he didn't talk at all.
Right. I know he had a lot of problems with that, and I don't know. That's something people just don't take into account.
Got fired because of it from one airline.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I heard.
How do you now remember that special year with John, or maybe it was more than a year, but the time, period of time you spent with John and you went through all of that, how do you now remember that? Do you remember it fondly? Do you remember it as something you wish you hadn't done, or what?
Oh, no, those are fond memories. It was fun and exciting back then, you know, before all the problems started and all the hassles from the feds and whatnot, but... Yeah, back in the early days, before all this became popular and Area 51 was on the tip of everybody's tongue,
mm-hmm.
You know, we were sneaking around out there when there were minimal security and whatnot, and I had the test flight schedule at that time, so we knew exactly what was going to happen and what was going on. And
well, you know what I'd like to know? Why did you, I mean, you at that time had a pretty damn good, secure job at an extremely secret place. What made you decide to grab John by the collar and say, hey, buddy, I can show you something? I mean, how do you make that choice?
I have to place myself back in that time. Well, that's kind of a loaded question because there was a lot of stuff going on at that time. And, you know, I kind of make a long story short. At the time, they were just calling me out, usually at night, on specific days to go out there when I initially started working down at the test site.
Right.
And, you know, this was causing problems with my wife at the time because I was keeping everything confidential, even from her.
Sure.
And, you know, here at 11 or 12 o'clock at night, I get this call
and you gotta
go. I disappear. And, you know, and this happens time and time again. And
where are you going, honey? I'm sorry, I can't talk about that.
Right. Yeah, I'm going to work. I'm sure you are.
Yeah.
You know, and as this goes on for quite a while, suspicions begin to build up. And, you know, I kind of kept my friends at arm's length at that time because I just didn't want any problems. I wanted all the, you know, this newfound security to go smoothly.
Sure.
And was pretty much playing with the game. So it started causing suspicion in my friends and, you know, immediate family and that sort of thing. So I decided to take the risk one night and just bring everybody out close enough to where they could see a test flight when I knew a test flight was going on.
Yeah, but you had to know what you were risking, right?
Oh, I did. And, you know, I can't really say what the actual motivation was back then, you know, specifically what made it, you know, what made me snap on that day. But
were you angry at them? Were you showing?
No, not at that point.
Were you showing off? There's nothing wrong with that, by the way. I mean, if that's what it was, that's what it was. I mean, I can understand.
No, it really wasn't that, you know, and that would actually be an easy answer, but... it really wasn't that. If I recall, that we didn't start butting heads until after that.
Right.
But that was about it. I think it was to alleviate suspicion and show, you know, several of my friends what was going on.
What was really going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How much, during those sojourns, how much did you actually get to see along with John?
While we were out of the area or while I was actually working there in the area?
Well, yeah, they're two separate things. No, I meant when you took John and others up there. Was it convincing for those who came along with you? There was no question in their mind about what they were seeing.
Oh, no, there was no question. I mean, John hauled out his, even though we got much closer in than you can today, near the area. Well, I have no idea what it's like today, but at least when I was last in Las Vegas a few years ago, you really couldn't get very far out on the road. But we drove in close to 10 miles, and you can't do that anymore. But John hauled out his Celestron 10-inch telescope, and from there it was quite a view.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and you were seeing saucers.
A saucer, yeah.
A saucer.
Mm-hmm.
Hovering, moving, doing...
Yeah, mm-hmm. It just lifted off the ground and hovered around.
Do you have any idea? Now, of course, you actually, it's another story, but I mean, you of course, got in to see the real McCoy. You saw how many saucers ultimately at S4?
Well, there were nine total.
Nine total.
But, awesome. You know, these were seen at a distance. The only one I actually had direct contact with was the one that was being test flown.
Uh-huh. Do you have any idea how they sufficiently back-engineered whatever in the hell they found inside that saucer to be able to test fly it? Do you have any idea what went on to learn about? I mean, there must have been... I mean, what was it like inside this thing? What was it like? If you were standing there looking at it inside, what would you be seeing?
Well, I guess the most shocking thing about it is it was... Everything was one color. There was no aesthetics at all. Everything was a light gray. And it was as if, and I've said this before, it was as if the entire device was carved out of wax, heated for a bit and cooled off. There were no sharp edges, no right angles. Everything was rounded and smooth, both inside and out. There are no seams or anything like that.
It had been done from a mold or something?
Right, like a giant injection mold of some sort. But, so that's it. That was probably the most obvious thing you'd notice when you walk in there. It just didn't look conventional at all.
Any idea, again, I mean, from that, could you see, how did they navigate this thing? Were there buttons? Were there joysticks?
I have no idea.
No idea. And so you would have no idea then how they back-engineered. It would have to be a pretty dangerous thing to take a craft that you just had and try to figure out how to fly the damn thing.
I imagine so, and from the stories I've heard, that it was quite a dangerous thing. But unfortunately, a lot of this went on way before I ever got there. And obviously, they had at least found out to some extent how some of the systems and subsystems operated.
Mm-hmm. Do you know how they got their hands on these in the first place? I mean, how did they get them?
I don't know. Unfortunately, a lot of the information's compartmentalized, so no one person has the whole story about everything, and that's typically done in any government project.
Absolutely.
So nobody can walk away with, you know, the whole project or knowledge of everything. But, I wish I had the complete picture.
Sure.
Of what was going on. Even just smaller pieces to the picture I did have, I would be very interested in how the navigational system operated. That still kind of puzzles me, as do flight controls and things of that sort. But
and propulsion? This element, what is it, 116?
115,
yeah. 115. Element 115. Do you have any concept of how the propulsion system did what it did? I know how a jet plane moves from A to B and so forth and so on. I mean, how was this element 115 used to move the craft? What kind of propulsion system is it?
It's a gravity propulsion system, something that's completely alien to us, if you don't mind me saying that.
That's a good word, yeah.
Instead of an action-reaction system, I guess the analogy I always use is if you go put a bowling ball in the middle of your bed and 3 feet away from it, push your fist into the bed and push down really hard, the bowling ball rolls towards it.
That's correct.
And what happens in these craft, or in this particular one anyway, there were three gravity amplifiers in them. And what these are long tubes that are in the belly of the craft, and they're on kind of a universal pivot type joint, to make it simple. It's actually something more complicated than that, but what they can do is swing two of the emitters up at one time, focus on a point in front of the craft, and cause a local distortion, and essentially the craft moves forward towards it just like the bowling ball would.
So it's falling into a path it's making for itself.
Right. It's kind of constantly rolling downhill, so to speak.
Yeah.
Which is the opposite of how our vehicles travel. We always accelerate air, throw exhaust out the back, do something to propel something forward. and in the air anyway. And this essentially operates the opposite.
Now, is it dependent on a local field of gravity? In other words, obviously these ships are designed to fly through interstellar space, and I wonder what if they're using gravity in that manner, then how does local gravity, I wonder, affect them? In other words, the Earth has gravity, and when they're within our field, is it any different than when they're in interstellar space in terms of the way it operates?
Yeah, completely. There's two different modes of travel. There's Delta and Omicron.
Oh?
And the Omicron configuration is when the craft uses one of the emitters to essentially hover on and causes that local distortion with the other two in front of it.
Right.
Causing it to move forward.
This is something I've never heard before. Okay.
Oh, the Delta configuration. In fact, let me take a step back for a second. That's how the craft is flown in an area of gravity. Now, when you want to leave a local area of gravity, say fly into space, what is done is you transition from Omicron to Delta. And in a lot of the UFO pictures you see occasionally, you'll see these UFOs at these ridiculous angles, at 45-degree angles hanging in the middle of the air.
Sure.
And the reason for that is that's the transition between the two different flight modes.
Ah.
As the craft lifts off the ground, it has to fly in a gravity-free environment in space with the belly forward. It doesn't fly like a flying saucer does in a science fiction movie. The emitters focus on one point,
right?
All three of them out in space, and that's how the thing travels. So you're kind of going from a conventional mode of flight, lifting up in the air, raising the belly, and then aiming that towards your target, and that's how you progress.
Bob, knowing what you know about at least the propulsion system, what can you imagine that might go wrong and cause a craft to crash, as it allegedly did, for example, at Roswell?
You know, I've wondered about that for a while, and I really can't see how one of these things could crash. But apparently it did. But I can't see where a failure is going to typically occur. I don't care if there's a lightning storm or what locally is going on, unless there was something that occurred within the craft. I don't think there's any external force that's going to act on it, certainly any natural force, and cause any problems, because if you're generating your own gravitational field, you're essentially immune to everything that's going on around you.
Hmm. If that field should fail for some reason?
Well, yeah, that's why I say if some defect occurred inside, or if something was done unintentionally as far as piloting the craft, that I could see happening. But I don't buy the story somebody comes cruising in from 30 light years away, runs into a thunderstorm and crashes into the ground.
Yeah, you bet. Are you convinced that Roswell was, in fact, a crash of an alien craft?
No.
Oh, really? Now, there's a surprise.
Well, you used the word convinced. There's a lot of information that leads me to believe that, but, you know, I'm one of the most skeptical people when it comes to flying saucer stories, and I know that almost sounds hypocritical, but that's just the way it is. Becoming involved with, you know, one aspect of it kind of cemented that in my mind. But, you know, boy, there's lots of wacko stories out there, and I'm sure you've heard your share of them, more than anybody.
Perhaps I have. But you know, if this propulsion system, I mean, it could mean so much for the world. If we knew how to manipulate gravity in that way, that obviously would be a power source that could be harnessed and utilized in a world where we're running out of coal and oil and all the conventional stuff we've used. We really badly need another energy source. When you saw these saucers, it was how many years ago now?
Well, it was in 88, 89.
And now, 2003, we're starving for energy. We're probably going to have wars. We are having wars because of it, and there'll be more wars because of it. So why do you suppose, Bob, that all of this has been kept from the world?
I don't know. There's also, you know, there's also a tremendous weapon potential here.
That too.
You know, a tremendous weapon potential, maybe more so than energy, because as far as duplicating the power system, well, you need access to materials, elements, things of that sort that we simply don't have and cannot fabricate. And
well, you know they'd be making weapons.
Well, yeah, of course. Of course. You know, if you can control, I think I said this on my last interview with you, you know, we have devices that can produce magnetic fields. We have devices that can produce artificial light. But, you know, the big gap is we don't have a machine that can make gravity. You know, there's nothing that does that.
Well, either that,
that's a big gap in physics.
Or we haven't made it public. And the question is, why is this technology still buried? I tell you what, we're at the bottom of the hour. Hold on, Bob. We'll come back and we'll jump right back into the same place. It's what Dr. Greer, who, by the way, will be here tomorrow night, a lot of other people want to know about, why is all of this being kept secret. From the high desert, this is Coast to Coast AM.
Listening to the best of Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is, and my guest, of course, is Bob Lazar, the very controversial Bob Lazar. He's a physicist, and he's actually been where few living human beings have ever been, and that's standing right in front of the real McCoy. UFOs, flying saucers, flying discs, one described, I recall, as the sports model, but the real thing. In fact, I believe what Bob saw resulted in the tester model. Do you remember the tester model of the saucer? Well, that came from, at least in part, if not in totality, Bob's description. I think that's right. We'll ask about that in a moment. Bob Lazar. The ability to create or manipulate gravity, some incredible thing to be sure. And Bob, we were talking about the energy needs of the world, and then you brought up weapons, and you betcha. I mean, do you believe, for example, that they have, in fact, developed weapons using this technology and that we have them now in our arsenal?
My own personal belief, absolutely.
Absolutely, huh?
Absolutely, because I saw evidence of that even when I worked there. Part of the briefing contained a couple hints about using gravity as a lens, or one of the gravity emitters as a lens to focus energy weapons. So which, to take a step back, if you're particle beams and other energy-type weapons of that sort, disperse quickly in an atmosphere. And it's kind of hard to keep a focused, intense beam on your target. But if you can manipulate gravity, you can really, really change the dynamics of that. So,
what would such a weapon do?
Well, that's what they're using, a technology there essentially to focus something that's conventional. But if you could maintain the energy density, maintain, essentially a tight focus spot
right.
of any high-intensity energy, you could burn, penetrate, destroy different targets. But also, it's also a great defensive thing because once you start talking about manipulating gravity, and you can create a gravitational field in any plane you wish, things that become possible are what we consider science fiction. Now, the popular shields in Star Trek become possible now.
Well, how about the not-quite-so-as-fictional suggestions made by Ronald Reagan about Star Wars?
Right.
You got to wonder if some of what that man said at that time came from some knowledge he might have had about what was possible.
It could certainly have had. I've heard several people talk about Reagan in that way, and I know he made several of those
yes, he did.
Speeches with making reference to aliens invading the Earth. And,
that's right.
And whatnot. But, that's very possible.
Certainly, that would have been one of the early conclusions any military mind would have drawn, and that could have easily made it to the top to the president. Ronald Reagan was somebody who said what was on his mind to the consternation of many around him. He'd just say what was on his mind. And.
Mm.
To hell with the consequences. So one does have to wonder about that. But still, there it is. Maybe we've got the weapons. We didn't use them in Iraq.
No, I think these are way too valuable to use in combat. These aren't things that have been produced. We're using the parts from the craft, and they're prototypes, and I don't think anybody is risking putting these valuable things into battle. I think it's, unless we've developed another source for the materials or have been able to duplicate them, in the past 10 years, I really don't see that we're going to be going anywhere with that. But who knows? Maybe by this time research has continued and they've actually come up with something.
One of the key things that John Lear did during our last interview was he said, "Hey, Art, I'm going to take you to a briefing, and you're going to get to say whether you think all of this, there should be total disclosure about everything the United States government has done since day one regarding this whole issue of extraterrestrials, what we've learned, what information we have, how we got it, what we've done with it, the terrible things government has done to protect the secrets and all the rest of it. I'm going to lay it all out for you, and you decide whether or not it should be all publicly disclosed." Everybody in ufology is screaming for disclosure. And so I'm wondering about you, Bob. If you had a litany of things laid in front of you that we had done, some of them pretty terrible, if you buy it, would you say that there should be full disclosure, or is this something better kept from the American or the world public?
Well, it's not better kept from the American people because, we're supposed to be the government. We hire these guys, elect them to their positions to take care of business.
Yes, sir.
So nothing is supposed to be kept from us. However, there are other countries. We do have an awful lot of people in the world that just hate us because we're alive. And, if you're concerned about weapons and the proliferation of things of that sort, you do need to keep certain things secret from the rest of the world. However, it's one of the things that I had said initially, go ahead and keep all that stuff secret, but just admit, hey, by the way, a long time ago, we ran into some of these things. This technology is real. There apparently is actual intelligent extraterrestrial life somewhere else. And, you know, we have a few artifacts and, you know, go ahead and release some stuff to the public. So, look, here, you know, here's a hinge made on another world. Just something generic. And, you know, keep all the other stuff secret. But then I can also see the flip side of that. That's going to whet everybody's appetite, and there's going to be a furor over, you know, disclosing the rest of the information. And if the government's been keeping that for secret for so long, what else have they been keeping secret?
But well, yes.
I don't see the government coming clean with any of this stuff. I mean, they're up to all kinds of no good, so...
Do you believe that there is a government behind the government, you know, sort of pulling the strings, as it were?
I don't know about that. I think ours is pretty screwed up as it is, so I don't think it needs anybody else pulling any strings.
Yeah, you're right about that. But surely there is some method for keeping this gigantic secret, and not all politicians, nor even perhaps all presidents are told about the existence of that. Do you believe that?
No, I think very few people know. And one of the things they told me, which was one of my first comments there when I finally knew what I was working on, how do you guys keep this secret?
Yeah.
And what they told me was, this is the easiest thing in the world to keep secret because it's so unbelievable. And, you know, when you really think about it, they're right.
Well, they are, because everything just gets dismissed or perhaps erased. How much anger do you have for them now? I mean, what they did to you. They virtually erased your life. They brought a steel fist right down in the middle of your life and kind of ruined things for quite a while for you.
Well, I don't know. I've tried to put this out of my mind, you know, as I fight to try and just put this behind me and forget about everything. You know, a lot of people keep prodding me for information, and, you know, it resurfaces in my mind. But for the most part, I just try and get rid of this. At the time, sure, I was pissed off, more so than you can possibly imagine.
Mm.
And, you know, as my friends at that time recall, I drove around in my little 280Z with an Uzi. You know, that's the kind of trouble I expected, and I didn't go anywhere without it. But, you know, times have changed. A lot of time has gone by, and I don't know. It's kind of hard to say. Yeah, it's always in the back of my mind, but, you know, what am I going to do? To this day, I'm still fighting to get some paperwork and, well, some things I can't even talk about, but back to the way it was, so I can be a normal person.
You obviously thought they were going to kill you.
Oh, no question. That was the impetus for going on the news that one night.
Yeah, and the famous or infamous Channel 8 thing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You wanted to tell everybody about that? Because, of course, not everybody in the rest of the country either recalls or knew about what happened with regard to that. Explain exactly how that came down.
Well, I'm wondering how far I should go back. Well, essentially, after I left the project, and it wasn't really voluntary, but I'm trying to remember exactly what happened then. I think it was John, that interview took place at John Lear's house.
It was George Knapp that talked you into it, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a combination of both. I think I had gone down to John Lear's house and really was afraid to go home at that time and hid out there for a while. And John said, why don't you go talk to George Knapp, and maybe if the stuff's all over the news, they'll just leave you alone. It'd be your way of kind of pushing back. So.
George Knapp, folks, is a reporter for Channel 8, the CBS affiliate in Las Vegas.
And yeah, George, he was I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, that's all right. George is just a very heavy-duty investigative reporter for that station. And I guess he was sort of doing stories on John Lear at that time, and then somehow you got involved in this. And then, if I remember correctly, you were put on television in a shadow behind something, or I can't remember.
Yeah, it was just a backlit shadow, so you know, you couldn't recognize who I was, and the pseudonym I used was the name of my boss at the time, which was kind of a little smack in the face to say, hey, just back off and leave me alone. And apparently that caused quite a stir, and I got a call shortly after that, and needless to say, they were pretty upset with that move.
Do you think I bet they were. Do you think John wanted you to do it to, in essence, back him up at that point?
Oh, I'm sure. At that time, I mean, you have to look at things at that time. First of all, I got into the project thinking I was going to be working on a new fighter, a propulsion system for a new fighter aircraft.
Yes.
And I was certainly not one of the people that believed in UFOs. These were people that were just, you know, something to laugh at as far as I was concerned. So I already lost my train of thought.
Well, let me put you back in that chair and that night when the interview got done, was done. What did you say to the audience that night?
Well, that was essentially just admitting that there were 9 craft out there that they were actively back engineering and, you know, attempting to duplicate the power and propulsion system of the craft. And that's basically about all that was said. I mean, there were a few details about where it was. And
that was enough. That's like taking a match and throwing it on gasoline. What was the reaction like after that?
It was pretty widespread.
Yeah, I bet.
It went all over the place. You know, I had seen, because they I don't know if they interrupted it, but it was in the middle of the 5 o'clock news.
They did
a live broadcast, and I've seen that exact broadcast repeated on Japanese television and, you know, in Germany. So it made the world fast.
What was the nickname you used
for
that interview?
Dennis,
yeah, that's right. They called you Dennis. It's a long time ago now. That must have taken great big ones to sit in that chair and say that on television. God.
Yeah, Dennis Mariani was my supervisor at that time.
I see. Okay, so after that story broke, I mean, you and John probably just sat back and watched the world explode around you.
Well, kind of. Yeah, I mean, at that time, you know, John Lear was out there himself saying that there were flying saucers at the test site and, you know, all kinds of stuff that I thought was pretty silly. But as it turned out, you know, he was right. I don't know what information source he had at that time, but
he'd been telling you and saying that. So I guess maybe that's the reason that you went to John, as dragging him along, saying, hey, I got something to show you. Maybe you just sort of felt as though you owed it to him in some way, huh?
Maybe. I actually can't remember the exact reason, but it was just the people around me at the time I felt obligated to at least give a peek to.
Wasn't the tester company that makes models came out with a model of a UFO, of a flying saucer, quite a unique scale model of a flying saucer. I have one of them. And how much of your input was used to create that model?
Oh, 100%.
100%?
Yeah. Yeah, John Andrews from Testers just sat down and said, hey, we want to make a model of this, and you want to help us or not? And I said, yeah, okay, this is it. And
okay.
They brought a couple guys in, and you know, off the top of my head, I tried to remember some dimensions, and we did some initial drawings, and the craft just didn't look right. And he had a couple friends that were, I don't quite remember what they were skilled in, but in any case, they were able to get the correct dimensions by me recognizing the sizes of known objects at various distances.
Sure.
And they kind of, you know, back engineered it from that and were able to get the proper dimensions. And when the drawing was done, that did look correct. And I think I'm more comfortable with the final drawings and dimensions they came up with. And it came up like to 52.8 feet in diameter or something like that.
Well, when you look at the tester model today, do you look at that and say, yup, that's what I saw?
Yeah, no question. That they hit the nail on the head with that.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it.
How long a process was that for you to accurately, finally, you know, I guess it's like going to a police station and going to a sketch artist and have them finally come up with something that matches, you know, the person you saw.
If I remember it took a while. It probably took a month on and off of going over drawings, drawing the layout over and over again, and, you know, having these guys look at it and then scale it up and see if things fit. But it did take quite a while.
All right. Am I right or wrong? Do you own a missile silo in Roswell, New Mexico?
Yeah, John Ferrat and I have a project going down there, and it's a decommissioned nuclear missile silo just outside of Roswell. And it's not like I wanted a place outside of Roswell. It just happened to be where it was.
Roswell, yeah. But how does a prison go about getting a missile silo in the first place? I mean, who do you approach?
Well, I think they're actually on the Internet. If you type in missile silo, there are a few left for sale. But they are pretty neat. It's, I believe, the main, where the missile sits, is 200 feet deep, and you know, these places are quite a deal compared to what the government paid for them. I think they paid close to $13 million just for the concrete.
Oh, I'll bet.
To build these places, and it's literally bomb-proof. You can set a thermonuclear bomb on the door and set it off and still be drinking beer inside for a while. Anyway.
Why did you want a silo?
Oh, it was cool.
Just because it's cool.
Yeah. Well, we also have some other plans for it, but
that you can or can't talk about.
Nah, I'm really not obligated.
You really can't talk about it. Yeah, I see. So this is a full decommissioned nuclear missile silo.
Yeah.
In Roswell.
Yeah.
Just not something that the average person would have or want, and I wish I knew what you were going to do with it, but you can't talk about that at all, huh?
Well, not really. I can tell you some of the things we're not doing with it. We had
you're not launching missiles.
We hope. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a reload kit for the place, but I would certainly have bought one if I could.
I see. All right, hold that thought. We'll be right back. It's top of the hour. My guest is Bob Lazar. He owns a missile silo in Roswell, New Mexico. And he'll tell us shortly things that, I guess he's not going to tell us. He's going to tell us things you can't do with it, or he can't do with it, or maybe things that he will do with it. We'll see what we can pry out of him next.
Well, now you step inside, but you don't see too many faces. Coming in out of the rain, they hear the jazz.
Can some people...